Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 111.
111.
111.
111.
111. 111.
What's that in bingo?
What?
What's the bingo number for 111? Is that the thing?
Bingo.
111, isn't it? 100 and... legs. No, that doesn't make sense.
I don't think... Does bingo cards don't go up to 111, do they? Do they?
I don't know why it came into my head.
We keep going, what are the bingo calls? And we've never learned them.
Never played bingo. Who knows?
It's not known in the true crime circles for people shouting bingo calls while murdering people, but...
Well, you're in for a treat then, aren't you, this week?
Is there a murder in a bingo hall?
Bingo hall murder. Oh, that'd be a good one.
Oh, we've got to find one. People, write it. Don't do it, but write it. Find it for us. We should
murder with those stampy pens. Someone called out bingo before you got there. I can imagine the rage of some pissed up
pensioners. I mean, this is the stuff great miniseries
absolutely
are made of.
Absolutely.
How are you, Nick?
I'm going to Netflix.
Yeah, you got big plans.
Writing this up as we speak.
You have your pre-cocktail.
My pre-cocktail.
How many have you had?
Some.
Oh, that's never a good answer. One or two, and then someone is holding someone's hair back over the toilet, aren't they?
After that, it becomes a cry for help, but there we go.
What are you drinking as your pre-cocktail?
I had. Oh, this is not going to go well. Oh, dear. We shouldn't have had them. I started with an Alaska. Nice and sharp and zingy.
Zingy. But it's got the twigs in it.
It's got the yellow twigs.
Oh, the
gin, yellow twigs. That's it. Cold.
It's like yellow snow.
No, it's not. And now I've moved on to a bijou.
A bijou. No, you do like a bijou.
Yeah, I had one of those last week as well. I hadn't had one for ages.
And what's in a bijou again?
You have gin.
Yeah.
You have red vermouth.
Yeah.
You have the green twigs. And some orange bitters.
Ooh.
And stirry. Drinky.
Glubby.
Folly.
Bodes well for a podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
You also made me a mystery drink.
What is the drink?
I don't know.
You've had this drink before? You like this drink?
Okay.
What is it?
Is it a Martinez?
It is a Martinez! Yay! Well done. Points for Sinead.
Not kidding. Panicked. Panicked there and just say a bloody drink, Nick will
but
kill
you. You knew in your mind. You got it right.
And it is most delicious. A lovely Martinez. Oh, you know what, Nick? I mean, if people are interested in a Martinez, there might be a little video of that coming out on the old Patreon soon. Little demonstration of a Martinez. Any poisonings this week?
I had a ponder this one.
Ah.
Yes. I poisoned a Martinez. Well, you made me write two episodes in a row.
Full disclosure, people. Normally, Nick and I alternate the episodes each week. Tis only fair.
Tis fair, yes. Tis fair doing it that way, isn't it?
Fair doing it this way. You don't want to tug at this thread, Nick. Because
I really don't know.
No.
It'll unravel very quickly.
It's going to be another Nick episode this week. I'm going to go back to writing next week. I had a hell of a week, people.
You had a jolly time in podcast land.
I was in podcast land, yes. I was very busy. Many work deadlines. And then Nick very kindly offered and said, do you want me to do the episode this week? And I went, yes, please. Writing it and then editing it. And then it's a lot to do. Hence, all of the cocktails are laid out. Well, speaking of poisoning your friends' drinks and enjoying videos about how to make cocktails, I think it's time for us to thank our delicious new Patreon subscribers.
Yes, indeed we should. So thank you very much this week to Mr. Toasters. I like your name, sir. Well done.
Very good, sir. To 78 Toast Raccoon.
To Kayla Bigelow.
To Jen.
And finally to Amber Miner. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, all you lovely, sexy Patreon subscribers. There was a theme going
on
there.
There was a toast thing going on there for a while. Two toast-based people in a row.
I like toast.
I may need some toast after this.
You will definitely need toast after this. Thank you, delicious Patreon subscribers. Thank you for joining us. If you would like to have extra episodes every week from the Poisoner's Cabinet, including bonus content such as videos and also bloopers, outtakes, you can join us for but $5 or £4 a month. Completely flexible, and it's good.
It's great. That's great. We're 93 episodes or something mad.
Nearly 100 episodes. And you get access to the full back catalogue when you sign up. Well, Nick.
Hello.
Ah, you're ready.
God, no.
To drink cocktails and talk about poison.
It's a curious accent you've got going on there.
Or we could drink some poison. Talk about cocktails.
You've been listening to Old Gods of Appalachia just a bit too much.
I wish I could do that guy's voice. Oh.
That's a good voice. I like it.
No, if I did the Old Gods from Appalachia voice, which is a great podcast, people listen to it if you haven't found it already. No, you'd be terrified. You'd be crying.
I would be crying.
It's terrifying. But what's it going to be, Nick?
I would like a story. Since I wrote a story, I would like to tell it.
You would like a story. You would like you telling
it. I would like me telling it. They're the best type of stories. They're me stories.
Let's go with the first one. Hooray, hooray, hooray. Nick's story this week. Again, double whammy, people. But of course, we can't possibly have a story without more cocktails in hand. Every week, dear listeners, as you know, we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell, and it will flavour our cocktail of the week. Nick's story, so his pick. And this week's secret ingredient is...
some lovely, lovely peaches.
Peaches?
Everyone loves a peach.
Oh, everybody does love a peach.
Everyone loves a peach.
Does anyone not love a peach?
Not quite. I haven't had a peach for a long time. It's not a fruit that I will go, oh, I'm going to have a peach.
Yes, it's not... dare I venture that in the UK, it's not a hand fruit, but we put it in a lovely crumble or in a tart.
Yes, that's very nice. But yeah, you don't just pick up a peach like you would an apple.
No.
Or an orange or something like that. And
go, maybe a nectarine. A good way of peaches.
Yes.
Grill it on the barbecue.
Oh, yes.
And a nice scoop of vanilla ice cream.
Absolutely. A bit of honey.
Honey. Oh, honey. A little
some
maple
nuts,
syrup.
Some nuts for a bit of crunch.
You're doing the hand gesture.
I don't have my hands.
Demerara sugar.
Oh, exactly. You want a bit of texture.
A bit of texture. But we're not having that.
Oh,
I take
no,
it.
I want that.
Can we have some grilled peaches? Drizzled in Malibu.
Malibu.
So with peaches, I'm thinking a certain variety of peach drink, which is famous. The old peach snaps could figure.
I was wondering what you're going with there. But yes, but you're absolutely right. We are going down the peach snaps route.
Well, I'm excited because peach is delicious, proper ingredient, and makes for a lovely drink. Sometimes quite sweet, but I trust you, Nick. I trust you to come up with something delicious.
So this week, we're going to have a peach tea.
A peach tea?
A peach tea.
Oh my, I feel like a Southern Belle.
Quite.
I'm going to fan myself out in the veranda, have cool peach tea as I welcome my gentleman callers. Don't act like you wouldn't be at the top of the stairs in a fabulous gown.
I would with an umbrella and
indoors.
Indoors, absolutely.
Just play along, Senator. So good of you to ride into town.
This is my walk in petunia.
A lovely peach tea. I don't know why we're making this Southern.
And also why we're being desperately offensive to many, many people.
Many,
so
many, many people. We're very, very sorry.
Yes, we're having a peach tea.
A peach tea. Delicious. Okay, I'm excited. Wow. Well, I think it is time for some tea for Nick, definitely. I think it is time for us to hop into the poisoner's cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
We'll see you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
Oh, Nick. Got a peach tea
peach
on the go.
Yeah.
Now, this is very pretty, but it looks like a long drink with some ice.
Bit of ice going on there.
Don't normally have that.
We don't. No, this is true. No. So I've moved back from the spirit forward drinks.
Which I think is wise for
you
right now.
Which I think is absolutely wise. Yes, absolutely.
A clinky drink. You will hear the clinking through the story, everyone. But yeah, looks like a nice iced tea kind of variety. Yeah. Oh, I'm intrigued. Okay, so, well, down
Merry,
the hatch.
Merry
Let's
Christmas.
Give it a go. Oh, you can really smell and taste the peach.
You really can, actually.
Wow.
That's intriguing.
That really does taste like an iced tea, like a peach iced tea.
That's very pleasant.
That's really refreshing. You get a hint of the alcohol at the end, if you see what I mean. You know, you foot forward taste and then middle and then sort of, and then the aftertaste has got a hint of alcohol to it. That's dangerous.
It's very dangerous. Oh, but I can imagine that being a fantastic... summery drink, sitting in the garden.
Oh god,
and
yeah,
just drinking buckets of that, and then at the end of the evening not being able to walk and wondering why.
Whatever you've done there, actually, you've made some sort of alcoholic peach tea.
that's going into the summer repertoire, I feel.
Symphony of flavors for the ears and for the mouth.
Oh, I'm pleased with that. I'm very pleased with that.
Oh, lordy, lordy. I'll never be poor or thirsty again. So talk us through it.
Someone on the social, I can't remember which one it was, made a comment that peaches go incredibly well with bourbon. And they are absolutely, absolutely right.
Ooh.
So this is a peach tea. We have peach schnapps. Yes, absolutely.
Of course.
But we have bourbon. So we have the peach and bourbon. We have a bit of Cointreau in there as well. So a bit of an orangey twang. Less than the other two ingredients, but a bit of Cointreau. And then a cold black tea. So it's just I brewed up some English breakfast tea. Leave it to let it go cold. and it works really well. And that's it. Just four things. Stereo, stereo, stir. Bit of ice. Lovely.
Well, that's dangerous, though.
Yeah.
Because you listed far more spirits in there than I thought were in there.
So you've got an ounce of the bourbon, an ounce of peach schnapps, half of Cointreau, and then 1.5 of the tea. All stirred with ice and then poured over ice to serve. So as you drink through it, it's going to get diluted. It's going to get weaker.
Oh, that is marvellous.
I can imagine that in a big pitcher.
Yes.
In a big pitcher or a big punch bowl or something like that.
And these are ingredients that you're probably going to have. The old peach schnapps, put it to elegant use, people.
And it's not an expensive drink.
Oh, God, no.
Oh, I'm very pleased with that.
I would worry for the hangover. Delicious drink. Peach schnapps, not the cleanest and purest of the alcohols. I mean, there is a place for every alcohol, people.
I disagree with that. I think if you buy decent stuff, it's going to be. If you get sort of supermarket own cheap, this is $5.99 peach schnapps, it's full of chemical flavorings and all that sort of stuff.
Lots of sugar.
If you buy decent, I must admit, this is not decent peach schnapps. What I've got is the supermarket.
Ooh, up on your soapbox you were there.
But if you can get the stuff, I think there's nothing wrong with a peach schnapps if it's a decent quality one.
Try not to go for the cheapest.
It's the same with any spirits, though, isn't it? So yeah,
it's the same with wine.
It's the same with wine. It's the same with gin. It's anything. You get the cheapest stuff, it's not going to taste very nice, and it's going to leave you with a blinding hangover because of all the crap that's in it. Spend a bit more on something, and you'll need to drink half as much.
That concludes our part of the cost of living crisis.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking that for me and my... Absolutely, buy the most expensive one. It's lovely. I've got loads of cash. Buy all this stuff.
No, I can't heat my home, but I have lovely schnapps. Well, we have our peach teas firmly in hand, fanning ourselves on a rocking chair on a veranda. It is a lovely day. We have got a lovely drink. Is it time for a story, Nick?
It most certainly is.
Woohoo!
Most certainly.
Slight trigger warning with this story. It does go to dark places about domestic situations.
If I were to say the name Buck Ruxton to you, what sort of character would that conjure up?
I'm thinking a rugged man. I'm thinking someone who is he's an outdoorsy sort.
Absolutely.
You know, tough and rough and tumble sort of person. I don't know how he likes it.
I entirely agree. So when I first read this name, I thought this is going to be some swaggering, probably American, tough guy. Yeah, it turns out entirely wrong. No.
Oh.
And as I read through the story of Buck Ruxton, he turns into someone quite different. Turns out that Buck Ruxton was born Bakhter Rustommy Hataj Hakim.
Good.
And was born nowhere near the Great Plains of America.
For they are great.
He was born in Bombay in India.
In
1899. Born into a very wealthy middle-class family. But for the sake of my sanity, though, we will stick with Buck Ruxton. Now, Buck has a very respectable upbringing. He's very intelligent, and he has received a first-class education. By his early teens, he has already decided that he is going to be a doctor. This is what he wants in life.
Ah.
This is what he is going to achieve. His family are delighted by this. Ooh. Doctor in the family. How very fancy. And they support his ambition wholeheartedly. Encourage their son, who goes on to study medicine at Bombay University, where he eventually qualifies in 1922. He then goes on to study surgery as well.
Marvellous surgeon.
He's trained. He's a trained surgeon. Now, as was the style of the time in India, Buck's parents are very keen to see their son wed. All the grandchildren who want the grandchildren.
Yeah.
And they have arranged a delightful match with Motibor Jingalaj Ghadli. And the two do indeed marry. Now, the marriage is not an entirely successful one.
No, which is shocking.
Not entirely successful. And when in 1926 he is given the opportunity to go and study in London, he jumps at the chance. Absolutely, yes. He leaves his wife in India, packs his bags, off he goes. When he arrives in England, he conceals all evidence of his marriage, apart from one occasion in 1928 when he contacts his father-in-law to ask for money. Now, when he's in London, he studies relatively briefly at University College in London before moving to Edinburgh in 1927. And there he works towards obtaining a fellowship at the Royal College of Surgeons. Very fancy.
Very fancy.
It is while he's in Scotland that it becomes apparent that the name Bakhter Rustommy Hanja Hakim is not perhaps the easiest for Westerners to deal with, as I'm ably demonstrating. And also, I mean, he is very determined to fit in. And so he changes his name.
Ah.
And he changes his name to Buck Ruxton. I'm still not sure how much he would fit it in with the name Buck Ruxton. Now, while he is in Edinburgh, he becomes acquainted with a 26-year-old Isabella Van S, who manages a cafe in the city. Now, when they met, Isabella was actually married to another man, a Dutchman, with whom she had a whirlwind romance. The marriage had only lasted a matter of weeks before they had separated. and she eventually goes back to using her maiden name of Kerr rather than Van S. But the two do begin a relationship. They begin courting. And when Buck eventually returns to London in 1928, Isabella goes with him. The following year, Isabella gives birth to the couple's first child, a daughter named Elizabeth. But soon enough, Buck, he does start to grow restless in London. He has got various jobs. He's working as a doctor's assistant or as a locum filling in here and there. But this is not where he wants to be. He wants to be his own man. He wants to have his own practice. So he decides that to progress his career, he needs to get out of London. There's far too much competition going on around here. So in the 1930s, the Ruxtons relocate from London to Lancaster.
Oh, very nice.
Where he establishes a medical practice at his new family home at 2 Dalton Square.
Excellent tea.
Absolutely. Now, as we know, since he arrived in the UK, Dr. Ruxton has made great efforts to assimilate himself into British society, changing his name, and he quickly acquires a reputation among his new patients as a very diligent and compassionate physician. He is well-respected, well-liked, and is incredibly popular within the community. He's even known to have waived his fees on several occasions for poorer people who couldn't afford a doctor, but he did it out of charity.
Good now, for
this
him.
Well, exactly. This own, but this endears him further to the great and the good of Lancaster. Hurrah for you, they say. The family settle in, and the following year, a second daughter, Diane, is born. And then in 1933, Isabel gives birth to a son named William. Now, it is after William's birth that the family decide that Isabel needs some more help around the house. And they employ Mary Jane Rogerson as a live-in housekeeper and nanny for the three children.
I see no way that this could go wrong.
Well, when you we shall see what happens.
When you build up a story and then suddenly a nanny is introduced very much in the middle of the story, I'm thinking, hey.
Well.
Maybe it's incidental. Don't
worry. We shall see. Buck may well have become a pillar of the community, but his home life is getting increasingly fraught with Isabella. His practice is flourishing, as he always hoped it would, but he spends more and more time visiting patients or locked away in his office. And as he does so, he becomes more and more suspicious that Isabella is having an affair.
With the maid?
Well, who can say? But no. So I can say.
Well, no way of knowing, except that we do.
Except that we do and it's not. His suspicions grow. He is an incredibly paranoid man. And it is reported that he frequently explodes into fits of rage or bouts of weeping hysteria and self-pity. So he swings between anger at his wife for cheating on him. And then the next day, he's crying his eyes out. Why don't you love me? I love you. Why won't you stay?
I mean, I think that's understandable. If you think your spouse is cheating on you, that, yes, you're going to be irrational.
Irrational is exactly the word we need for this.
I also, for a moment, when you said he frequently explodes, I was like, oh, that's extreme.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes, but his doctorly ways, he put himself back together. So it's all good. It's all fine.
Comes out and goes, well, I did that myself. I could live without you, you bitch.
On several occasions, these arguments would actually prompt Isabella to pack her belongings and return to Edinburgh with the children.
Love it. Drama.
Back to her family. Although the ensuing tearful phone calls from Buck, in which he begged her to come back, would eventually lead to her return to the house on Dalton Square. Now, we don't actually know for sure if Isabella was actually having an affair. It's very true that she was very popular around town. She had many, many friends that she would spend time with, go out with, go and socialise with. But it could well have all been in Buck's head. We just don't know. But he becomes increasingly erratic, accusing her of sleeping with pretty much anyone within a 20-mile radius.
Oh, Jesus.
He is convinced that she is sleeping with everyone in town.
Leads you to think she probably wasn't having an affair.
Yeah.
She's
indeed.
Just popular and she's a happy person.
Exactly. She's a young woman. And she wants to live a life. Absolutely. Yeah. So she's making friends and having a jolly time. But no, he's got to work at home and he's the one who's getting annoyed. On several occasions, the arguments get so loud and so screamy. The neighbours, yeah, I don't know why I went with that.
Technical term.
On several occasions, the arguments get so loud that the neighbours call the police to attend. On one of these occasions in 1933, Isabella complains to the police that her husband has begun beating her. When police question Buck, he denies he has assaulted his wife.
Obviously.
Alleging that Isabella has been unfaithful to him. As if that could be used as some sort of justification, which is like, no. On another occasion in April 1934, a policeman had again been called to the house following another quarrel. And as soon as the officer arrives, Buck tells him, "Sergeant, I feel like murdering two persons. My wife is going out to meet a man." So again, with this narrative of his wife is cheating on him, and whatever he does is justified because his wife is being unfaithful.
Well, clearly the police walk away.
The police do nothing. Absolutely. The police do nothing. On the evening of the 14th of September 1935, Isabella leaves the family home to visit Blackpool with two of her sisters who live in the area. They've gone to see the famous Blackpool illuminations along the seafront, and they're out quite late. Isabella doesn't leave Blackpool till around 11:30 at night, and she gets back to the house in the early hours of the morning. At the house, Buck Ruxton is waiting. He is convinced that Isabella has been out with one of her lovers. He has spent the whole evening working himself up into a frenzy of jealousy and paranoia and all sorts of horribleness. As soon as she walks through the door, he starts raging at her, and eventually it leads to his hands around her neck, and he strangles his wife into unconsciousness before stabbing her to death.
Oh god.
Good dark pretty quick there.
But Jesus.
Now this comes...
Stop it. No. New story.
This is the story. The commotion of the assault downstairs has woken Mary Rogerson, the maid, who is asleep upstairs, and she ventures down to investigate what is going on.
Please make her the heroine of this story.
Mary suffers the same fate as Isabella. She has caught Buck in the act, and she has to be silenced.
I am so sorry, Mary. I thought you were going to do a lot of comforting.
No, she ends up with the doctor's hands around her throat. It is now approaching dawn. Isabella and Mary are dead, strangled and stabbed. The doctor has regained some of his senses from his earlier fury, and he decides that he needs to do something fast. Soon the town is going to be waking, and hiding his crimes are going to be all the harder when there are people out and about. He wakes the three children, who have thankfully slept through the whole ordeal upstairs, and he bundles them into the car and races out of town. First, he stops at the home of Agnes Oakley, a charwoman that they employ, telling her that she's not needed at the house for the next few days. Don't worry about coming in. It's all good. Definitely don't go in the house.
So the body's still in.
The bodies are still there. He continues on to the home of a family friend, telling them that Isabella has gone to visit family in Scotland, and would they mind awfully looking after the children for a few days? He's got to work. He's very busy. Could they take the children?
I'm kind of glad the kids are okay.
Absolutely. The kids are fine. No harm comes to the children.
But he's just driving around town going, definitely didn't kill anyone. By the way, don't go in the house and look after my kids, and don't go in the house.
Yes. This is pretty much exactly what it is. He returns to Dalton Square alone, and there he drags the two bodies to the bathroom. And in the bathtub, he carefully dismembers the two women. With these two grisly tasks complete, he goes about the house ripping up carpets from the stairs. Anywhere that has been stained with blood or anything, he removes all the evidence. At around 4:30 that afternoon, Ruxton visits the home of one of his patients, a Mrs. Hampshire, and asks both her and her husband to return to Dalton Square with him to help him prepare for the decorators.
Whoa, what?
So when Mrs. Hampshire arrives at Dalton Square...
Great name, by the way.
Mrs. Hampshire.
She does sound like an Enid Blyton character.
She really does, absolutely. She finds the house in chaos, absolute chaos. Yeah. Carpet ripped up, wallpaper scraped off walls, all this sort of stuff.
I'm preparing for the decorators. Not well, my friend.
Exactly. That's why he really needs help. She would later testify that all the carpeting had been removed from the stairs. Several sections of the flooring were littered with straw.
What?
So I think he's thrown straw down to try and absorb things and what have you.
Okay, again, absorb, not remove stains. And also, why would that be a decorator's thing?
Don't think he was thinking clearly about any of this. In one room, Mrs. Hampshire discovers several rolled up sections of carpeting and a stained suit. In the garden, she finds a smouldering bonfire of more carpet and towels and cloths, all burnt to a crisp.
Oh, no, he's getting a little blood.
Now, before the Hampshires leave that day, as a thank you for their help, Ruxton gives the couple the stained suit.
What?
Saying that they can keep it as long as they thoroughly clean it first. And they go, thank you very much.
Here, have this red stain suit.
Have this red stain suit, but do clean it before you wear it.
Clean it. That's a shit gift.
It's a shit gift.
If you have just laboured all day,
yeah.
You know when a friend asks you around to paint their house, you expect a few beers or something.
Yeah.
Imagine someone turned around and said, have this shitty suit.
Now, here's my dry cleaning.
But is it expensive?
No, not at all. Sure, your husband would love it once it's given a nice scrub.
What kind of passive-aggressive token must you take that as? You clearly need a suit, and this will probably do.
That night, Ruxton loads his car with several tightly wrapped bundles and drives off. And that was that. No one is any the wiser. Ruxton thinks he's in the clear.
The fool.
A couple of days later, he visits the police, claiming that his wife had once again deserted him.
She has
run, left me. One of her lovers... She's scarpered.
Why is he telling the police
Well,
this?
He's getting ahead of any missing persons sort of thing. So if someone says, oh, she's missing,
okay.
He has already been to the police and said, my wife has run away. So
think it through, though.
Oh, no, it makes no sense. But in his mind, he is getting ahead of the game.
He bursts into the police station. My wife has left
me. My wife has left me.
That's not a crime, sir. No, she's run off again. So if anyone says she's missing, it's a filthy lie.
It's all lies.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Would you like a suit?
He also goes to visit the parents of Mary Jane Rogerson, the maid.
Oh, God, what does he say? What does he bring?
Now, there he tells them that their daughter has scandalously begun an affair with a local youth and become pregnant.
Ooh.
But not to worry, Isabel had agreed to discreetly take Mary away to get an abortion. They may be gone some time. Abortion is illegal at the time. Absolutely.
He is a doctor.
But he's sent them away. Isabel is looking after her far away. Now, Ruxton urges Mary's parents not to contact the police about this. Abortion is illegal. If they do, they're going to get their daughter in real trouble.
It's clever.
It's clever, but it's calculating.
Very calculating.
Very calculating.
Yeah, it's a smart, horrible move. Yeah.
And then all is calm. All is well in the world of Dr. Ruxton. Until on the morning of the 29th of September, 2 weeks after the murders, a young woman, Susan Johnson, is out walking near the small Scottish town of Moffat. On the banks of a stream, she notices a bundle of soaked clothes. Sticking out of this bundle is a partially decomposed human arm. Unsurprisingly, Susan runs into town to alert the police. Soon the countryside is swarming with constables, searching along the stream and its various tributaries, and there they discover three further bundles and two severed human heads.
He's just dumped them by the river.
Dumped them by the river.
By the river?
Well, I think in the river, and they've got caught up on bundles and rocks and things, on boulders and things as they flowed down.
Because I was wondering, we got to the river and went, nah, that's one step too far. I'll just leave them discreetly by the riverside. But how big is the River Moffat?
It's not huge, but it's sizable enough. I think the theory was that things had got dumped in a bit further upstream. There had been heavy rains, they got washed down, and then they got wedged in boulders and rocks and things on their way and just got stuck, and they didn't flow all the way
awful.
Through.
That's awful. Now there's just body parts strewn.
Yeah, absolutely. Body parts strewn around the place. On the 1st of October, a Dr. Miller and a scientist named John Gallister examined the contents of the bundles.
A scientist?
A scientist.
Batman?
Not Batman.
Batman's a scientist.
No, he's not.
Yeah.
not in Scotland.
Scottish lords.
Not in Scotland in 1935, he wasn't.
He was nearly there.
They report that of the four bundles recovered during the initial search, the first was wrapped in a blouse and contains two upper arms and four pieces of flesh.
Two upper arms. Oh, the bicep. Right.
Yes.
Two upper arms rather than the lower arms. You mean the legs.
No more peach tea for you.
I would not be good at a crime investigation. I
agree entirely.
I am not a scientist. I'd call myself a scientist. The upper arms and the lower arms and the lower hands are invisible.
The second bundle comprises of two thigh bones, two legs, two lower legs, from which most flesh had been stripped, and nine pieces of flesh, all wrapped in a pillowcase. Third was a piece of cotton sheeting containing 17 portions of flesh. The fourth parcel, also wrapped in cotton sheeting, consisted of a human trunk, two legs with the feet tied, and some wisps of straw and cotton wool. In addition, other packages opened to reveal two heads, one of which was wrapped in child's rompers, and again a quantity of cotton wool and sections of the Daily Herald, dated 6th of August, 1935.
Don't use the daily paper.
Two forearms with hands attached, but minus the top joints of the fingers and thumbs, and several pieces of skin and flesh, were also wrapped in the Sunday Graphic, dated 15th of September, 1935.
Okay.
Now, they go on to say that the remains, they put these pieces together.
Yeah,
and
I've lost count of how many
things there are. Lots of pieces there, but they jumble them all together like some really disturbing. And there's actually one report, this man is known as the Jigsaw Killer.
What? Only one?
One paper picks it, yeah.
That is a good name. And one paper, one journalist was just putting out there, the Jigsaw Killer. No one's going to pick this up? Seriously? The Limmy Stroony Man by the River. Like, oh, come on. No disrespect to the dead, but still, imagine someone was putting it together, the same person who didn't know what the upper arm and the lower arm was.
So you.
Yes, putting it together. Oh my God, it's a giant with two heads. It's clearly two people. No, they have six arms and one leg.
Thankfully, the scientists were somewhat more learned. They do decide that the remains are those of two females.
Oh, thank God.
Notably different heights and ages, but that the mutilation conducted upon the remains had been committed by an individual with extensive anatomical knowledge and had been done in a very obvious way to hide the identification.
These are the fingerprints of the remains.
Exactly. They are convinced that the mutilation had been entirely carried out with surgical implements. There were no axes or kitchen knives or anything like that involved. It's all with a scalpel. It's all incredibly precise. The murderer has removed the eyes, the ears, the noses, the lips, and several teeth from both heads to make dental identification impossible and also to make facial drawings impossible. With no nose, no eyes, no ears, they cannot create composite sketches to try and identify these people.
It would have been so much better if he hadn't just dumped them by the river.
Well, it comes in later, but I think that he was hoping that all these things would be washed out to sea. No. Now, police begin to search the local area for reports of missing women, but soon they find that no one is unaccounted for. There's no one local who is missing, leading to speculation that, now, as this river ran near a fairly major road, the killer could have come from miles and miles away, up the motorway, and dumped the remains over the side of a bridge or something. The two bodies are transported to the anatomy department at the University of Edinburgh, where further examinations are carried out. They hire an entomologist from Glasgow University to come and examine the remains.
Okay.
And he examines all the insect activity around the body in one of the very, very first times that sort of forensic entomology is used.
Oh, that's great. Say he rocked up in a safari suit.
That I don't know. I find it unlikely. From the incredibly clever use of blowfly larva, he is able to deduce that the remains are between 12 and 14 days old, which is more precise than anything has ever been before in sort of the history of identifying. Oh, she's a bit squidgy, therefore... Months old. And this man comes along and goes, no, 12 and 14 days. I can tell by these scientific things.
That's fascinating.
Which is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Just by looking at the larva.
The stages of the development of the various bugs and things.
He has a safari suit on and a massive magnifying glass.
He has
glass.
A massive magnifying glass.
He has the butterfly net in his back pocket should he need it.
Now, after they have got all the information they can from the actual remains, the experts turn their attention to the clothing and the papers that had been used to wrap up the body parts. They find that several of the pages of the Sunday Graphic in which the remains had been wrapped had been, in fact, a souvenir edition of the newspaper, which had been printed and circulated solely in the Morecambe and Lancaster area of England on the 15th of September.
Oh, for God's sake!
Strongly suggesting that the victims, or at least their murderer, lived in the northwest of England. They also found some of the clothing used in the bundles was very distinctive, with very colourful repair patches on the now very bloodied blouse, but something that someone would recognise if they were shown it. On the 1st of October, Mary Rogerson's parents visited Dr. Ruxton at his practice. They're the maid's parents. They come. They have heard nothing from their daughter at all. Does he have any idea of where she is? Is she okay? On this occasion, he claims that Mary and Isabel had broken into a safe and stolen £30 before running off together.
What?
And they would return once the money runs out. What about the abortion, they ask? Wasn't that what she ran away for? Oh, yes, that too. Yes, yes, and one too. They're both absolutely, completely fine and not at all dead. They're fine. They are beginning to suspect something may be slightly awry.
He just forgot his first cover
story. He forgot his first cover story, made something up. So they are beginning to lose faith in the doctor's explanations of their daughter's absence. The following day, they file a missing persons report with the Morecambe police. Now, when the police find out about this missing Mary Rogerson, they pay a visit to Mary's parents. Mrs. Rogerson immediately recognises the blouse with a patchwork repair as having belonged to her daughter.
Ooh.
They tell the police that they had last seen Mary on Saturday the 14th of September when she had visited on her day off. Looking into Mary's life, they discover that Mary's employer was the one and only Dr. Ruxton, a man who had informally reported his wife missing at exactly the same time by running to the police station going, "My wife's run away," and then leaving again. They think it is time to talk to Dr. Ruxton, but Ruxton gets there first. He arrives at Lancaster police station in a terrible state.
Oh,
absolutely terrible. He bursts into tears and complaining about all the local gossip that is quickly spreading about these remains that have been found in Scotland that are his wife and his maid. Absolute nonsense. How could anyone think such a thing?
Oh,
his
God.
Wife and the maid, they're perfectly fine. He would know if they were dead. He would feel it if they were dead. Can they please put a stop to all these rumours? It is incredibly damaging to his reputation and to his business. It's not on that people are allowed to spread these rumours. Unfortunately, it has wrought somewhat of the opposite effect, and police are now entirely convinced that this is the man they are looking for. Now they just need to prove it.
Generally, when someone bursts into a police station going, "I want to address these rumours." What rumours?
Yes.
There are rumours. There are rumours that I killed my wife, and I won't have it. I am very sad. I'm going to cry now. Give it a minute.
They speak to everyone in Ruxton's life. They find Agnes Oakley, charwoman, who confirmed that, yes, Dr. Ruxton had come by very early on the 15th and told her that she would not be needed. But when she had returned, the place was in such a state, carpets ripped up, smouldering bonfire in the garden, and a horrible yellowish discoloration in the bathtub. It was devilishly difficult to scrub out. It was. Speaking with the Ruxton's neighbours, police also discover that the doctor had asked Mr. and Mrs. Hampshire to clean his house in preparation for this redecoration. Apparently he was unable to do this work himself, as he had badly cut his hand opening a tin of peaches.
That was it?
That's it, that's it.
Oh, come on.
I was so desperate for an ingredient on this one. It's like, he cut his hand on a tin of peaches. That'll do.
The peaches were the greatest poison of them all.
Oh, a doctor man. And a can opener. It's a dreadful, dreadful thing.
Exactly. I can't possibly do anything because I cut my hand on some peaches.
Cut my hand on.
For God's sake.
The Hampshires are also quite happy to hand over the stained suit to the police. They hadn't worn it, or cleaned it. Around to cleaning it, so they're happy. No, he gave us this. You can have it. It's fine.
Anyone gives you something like that going, that's fucking evidence.
That's, exactly. I'm keeping
on. Goes in a bin bag.
On the evening of the 12th of October, Ruxton is arrested by a Lancaster police and questioned throughout the night. When asked to account for his whereabouts between the 14th and 29th of September, Ruxton produces a handwritten document entitled My Movements. Which he passes to the investigators before reciting word for word the document that he has just given them.
Well, he's memorised it.
He's memorised it.
And then he's handed it over.
Yeah, this is my statement of my movements.
Here's my movement. I mean, that could be misconstrued in many ways, obviously. It's just kind of your doctor. No, don't tell us about that. Oh, that is good energy. I like that. I like scripting in for the performance of your life, my sirs.
In the following interviews, Ruxton denies that he has ever been to Scotland since establishing his practice in Lancaster.
Never even heard of Scotland.
However, he is unable to explain why his car registration number had been reported by a cyclist who had been knocked down by a speeding car in a town near the Scottish border. He is also unable to explain why a police search of his house the previous day had revealed extensive traces of blood on the stairs. Mm. Not only on the stairs, but on the railings, on the balustrades, and the various carpets in various states of burntness. Moreover, he is unable to explain why traces of human fat and body tissue have been discovered within the bathroom drains. On the 13th of October 1935, Buck Ruxton is charged with the murder of Mary Jane Rogerson. A few days later, the charge of murdering his wife follows, Isabella Kerr.
Good.
The trial opens on the 2nd of March 1936 at Manchester High Courts of Justice. The prosecution claim that Ruxton, inflamed by jealousy and paranoia, has murdered Isabella Ruxton and Mary Jane Rogerson in the family home. That they had then discarded their bodies more than 100 miles away in the Golden Home Lynn stream in the southern uplands of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Ruxton's counsel based their defence on the belief that the bodies had been misidentified and that the two bodies were not those of Isabella and Mary Jane at all, but two other poor individuals who remain unknown. They also claim that the bloodstains found upon the suit, carpet and floorboards were merely a result of the house being used as a doctor's practice for several years. People come and go all the time, bleeding all over the place. It's going to get on the carpet. So what do you expect?
People are coming in just spewing blood all over the place, all over his suit, and he never cleaned his suit.
No,
the carpets, okay, we'll never get that
he's
out.
A busy man, he hasn't got time for that.
That's not a welcoming sight if you are a patient into a doctor's house. Okay, come into the house of blood, by the way.
No, you just wait, it gets better. The prosecution call numerous expert witnesses outlining their case, and each of these are the scientists who have been involved in the identification go into great detail as to how they have reached their conclusions and how they have been tested and proved correct.
Lovely.
The defence counter this science with explanations of their own. On one occasion, they state that the blood found on the balustrade within 2 Dalton Square could easily be explained. Easily. It may have accidentally spilled there during a birth. In the house, potentially. Or maybe even from a woman on her menstrual cycle while she was visiting.
No!
Both entirely possible explanations, I think you'll find.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, Nick.
You know, you ladies on your cycles, blood everywhere.
Everywhere. I'm bleeding all over the balustrades.
All on the balustrades.
It's just absolutely, it's like a sprinkler system when it happens. That's what happens. You walking down the street, sorry, excuse me. It's from a birth?
From a birth.
From a birth.
But on the balustrade, you would think maybe.
How was this child born?
Yeah, on a bed, potentially, if she was on a bed and something went slightly awry, yes, you would get blood or something. But on the balustrade, on the staircase?
Oh, that's so good. It's so good. That could have easily been from a woman's bits.
Mm, absolutely.
Let's blame it on them.
Blame it on them. No one's going to ask too many questions.
And all the men in the jury are like, yes, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Women
bleed
everywhere. It's entirely their fault. Baby shoot out and then the blood sprays 20 feet.
That's how it works. Absolutely.
I've seen it in stories.
The sole witness to testify on behalf of the defence is Ruxton himself. It is the defence's suggestion. They believe that the doctor is going to be able to evoke some sympathy from the jury. It does not go particularly well. When asked questions, he falls into bouts of hysterical sobbing, clutching his silk handkerchief and hysterically claiming that he has last seen his wife when she had taken Mary Jane Rogerson to Edinburgh to arrange the abortion. Last time he had seen her, she's alive somewhere. He knows it. He knows she is still alive.
Like the silk handkerchief.
The silk handkerchief. Good detail.
Very good. Very good.
He freely admits to frequently arguing with his wife over her alleged infidelity. But he is happy to justify his mental and physical abuse to which he subjected his wife by simply stating, "Who loves the most chastises most."
Which
makes me violently sick. The trial of Buck Ruxton lasted 11 days. The judge gives his final instructions to the jury, saying that Ruxton must be given the benefit of any reasonable doubt that may exist in their minds, adding, "If there is an avenue, let him walk down it to freedom. But if there is not, he cannot." The jury deliberate for just over 1 hour before returning a verdict of guilty.
Yes. Oh, thank God. I was really worried you were going to say not guilty there.
Buck Ruxton is sentenced to death. And when asked if there's anything left to say, Ruxton replies, "I am very sorry," before thanking the court for his patience and the fairness of his trial. The doctor then informs the judge of his intention to appeal the verdict. Now, the people of Lancaster are horrified at this result. They cannot believe that such a kind and helpful man would do such a terrible thing. Surely the court had got it entirely wrong.
We've seen it before. The honourable, respectable doctors. No, they wouldn't possibly do such thing. Blame the women. Blame the bleeding, spraying women.
Absolutely. Isabella and Mary, they are still out there somewhere, living at large, having a grand old time. Over 10,000 people sign a petition asking for clemency. But neither the petition nor the appeal make any difference.
Good. Oh, thank God.
On the morning of the 12th of May 1936, executioner Albert Pierpoint leads...
Albert Pierpoint!
Indeed. Leads Dr. Buck Ruxton to the gallows and to his death. The following day, a paper publishes Dr. Ruxton's confession. It is brief, reading... "I killed Mrs. Ruxton in a fit of temper because I thought she had been with a man. I was mad at the time. Mary Jane Rogerson was present at the time. I had to kill her."
It
was dated the 14th of October 1935, the day after his arrest. It had been left with instructions that it was only to be opened in the event of his execution.
What?
Or returned to him should he be acquitted.
Oh, that's...
So, with his lawyer...
That is cold.
There, the area in and around Golden Home Lynn, where Ruxton had disposed of the dismembered body parts of Isabella and Mary, became known locally as Ruxton's Dump.
Ruxton's Dump. Oh, my God.
The bathtub in which Buck Ruxton dismembered his two victims was removed from the house to be used as evidence at the trial.
Hey.
Now, unsurprisingly, it wasn't wanted back afterwards. So it was used as a horse trough by the Mounted Police Division at Lancaster County Police Headquarters.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
Why not?
Why not?
Just make use of it.
Don't skip it. We can make use of that. A nice horse trough. The story of Dr. Buck Ruxton.
Oh!
The Jigsaw Killer.
The Jigsaw Killer is much better as a title
it
than
really
anyone
is.
Has come up. Oh. Doctors, the greatest poison
absolutely.
Of them all.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll say Bastards, the greatest poison
yeah,
of them all.
Yeah, he's high up there.
Oh,
the Bastard Officer hasn't come out for a while, but he's high up on there.
He is awful. Oh, God, wife-beating. Ugh. Arrogant. But there's some brilliant explanations in there. I honestly am blown away that he wrote the confession the day after he was arrested.
Yeah, definitely
arrested. And he just was, in the event of my death or in the event of a conviction, you can bring this out. What?
Yeah.
I'm speechless at that. We've never encountered that yet.
Absolutely.
There may be other cases of it out there. He fucking knew.
He knew exactly what he was
doing. Of course he knew what he was doing. And he did this defense and he cried and he sobbed and he let them lambast these women and paint them in awful lights. And then it was just like, oh, well, when it's all run out. Yeah, of course I did it. What a piece of shit.
Yeah. Why he felt the need to write that is I find quite interesting.
I think it's arrogance.
Well, I think you're absolutely right.
Owning your own fate.
Yeah,
owning your
I think
own
it's
fate.
Absolutely right. It's that. No, I. Yeah, it's owning that and going, no, I did this. I'm still the one in power type of thing.
We've seen in other cases of, unfortunately, of doctors, and it definitely not all doctors, but more often when you've got some of these killers, it is the arrogance behind it. It is, I have to control the situation. They're often controlling with the people they end up killing. They're trying to control their own narrative and the story behind it. Obviously, there's one thing to defend yourself and there's one to create this whole persona.
Yeah.
And then still at the end, when you know what? We don't buy it. We don't buy it. Then none of this has worked. And then you suddenly turn around going, ha ha ha, I knew I was guilty the whole time.
Yeah. Okay,
that, what? Don't necessarily agree with the death penalty, but yeah, he gets his comeuppance, then just goes, oh yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. Yeah, I did it.
Did it after all.
But murdered and beat his wife and then murdered the maid because she wandered in on it. So it's not like it's a crime of passion that you can kind of go, oh no, I didn't know what I was doing. You absolutely knew
what was going on.
And all of the stories around it. Don't run into a police station crying, going, my wife, by the way, if anyone asks, my wife hasn't left me. No one was asking you, mate. It's 9 o'clock in the morning.
I mean, I very nearly didn't do this one because as you read through, it is a terrible story about this violent, violent man who is horrendously treating his wife and who murders his wife. But then you read on to the next bit, so just the craziness that came afterwards.
Yeah.
Of the how he decided he was going to deal with this thing that he had done, and the lengths he went to try and, I mean, he drove 100 miles to dump the bodies, dismember the things, and make up all these stories and tell different people different things that he couldn't keep track of himself, that all these lies that he had made up. Mm. And that was just absolutely mad. So I thought, no, it's a story that needs to be told.
Indeed. And, you know, let's not forget, we've said this many, many times over, you know, this is a historic podcast predominantly. We do try to find the humour in the situation. We look at cases where there is some humour around it. The act of murder and why they do it is always tragic, is always horrific, and we're not trying to belittle that. But sometimes you have to laugh. Otherwise, life is too depressing.
Absolutely.
You have to laugh at the explanations that people give later on, because we are fortunate enough to be able to laugh at it now and go, this is ridiculous, the idea that a woman came into a doctor's surgery. She just sprayed all over the balustrade.
It bled everywhere.
There was a birth, and then you just come out, okay, and just wipe your hands on the balustrade. It's absolutely fine. There we are. The banisters. Slide down the banister. That helps with the birth.
Absolutely.
The baby shoots round, and then you score 10 points. So the arrogance of some of these killers, you have to laugh at, and you absolutely have to kind of go with, you know what, and you know, screw you, you got your comeuppance, however we want to measure that comeuppance. Oh, it's a good story, Nick. There are some gems in
absolutely
there. Well, what do you think, people? What do you think about the Jigsaw Killer? I mean, that's such a good
it is
name.
It's one of the best ones we've had, yeah.
I mean, Jigsaw is like with Saw now, isn't it? It's been used
in
modern
films.
Parlance. Is there another killer or serial killer that's got Jigsaw as a name in real life? Tell us if you know. What do you think of all of the explanations? I mean, can you ever be sure that a woman hasn't bled secretly all over your house? Does it lower the resale value?
Like a haunting.
Pretty much, yes. What do you think of the case? What do you think of the motives behind it? Do you think... I mean, I think it's pretty cut and dry. How far on the bastardometer should he be? Are you keeping tabs of it? And do you have a placement that you'd like to share? Tell us what you think in the comments of any of the social media channels that you follow. Please share your thoughts with us, with friends. Talk about it online. Talk about it on Patreon if you're on there as well. But most importantly, for a very gruesome tale that is unfortunately not set in the Deep South and a hot continent.
I apologise for that.
Originated in a hot
area.
You must mix up a lovely peach tea.
Absolutely. It's gone down a treat.
Oh, that went down a treat.
Absolutely. I can imagine a big pitcher of that on a summer's day.
And we need big pitcher drinks.
Yes.
I think that aren't sweet horribleness.
Yeah. We go very heavy on the sort of the very short, sharp. Oh, well, that's my preference. Spirit forward drinks. But I think, yeah, as we're moving into summer, lighter, longer,
refreshing.
More ice, more refreshing. Absolutely. So I will endeavour to go into the summer months like that.
Sorry, you might have just heard me just go, because I just said one of the words that actually makes me cringe. Don't say it. No, I just said it and I managed and I was really proud of myself. And then I just went, ugh. There's certain words I can't say. Most of you will know this. Tell us what you think. Mix up a peach tea and send pictures of you guys enjoying cocktails. And some of you have been sending some brilliant suggestions of cocktails as well. Mm. We would love to make them. And come and join us on Patreon if you haven't already. And leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisoner's cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.